Our forum tonight is moderated by Vincent Canato, an associate professor of history at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. His research focuses on urban history, immigration history, and 20th century history. His first book was The Ungovernable City, a New York City in the Lindsay Era, and his new book, American Passage, The History of Ellis Island, is coming out from HarperCollins in June.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. We are discussing The First Tycoon with author T.J. Stiles. I'm Vincent Canato, associate professor of history at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Cornelius Commodore Vanderbilt, the first tycoon, founder of a dynasty whose very name conjures up wealth and luxury. In his new and authoritative biography of Vanderbilt, author T.J. Stiles looks at the man behind the myth. Born humbly on Staten Island and an unschooled fistfighter, Vanderbilt lived to earn the respect of New York's social elite and amassed one of the nation's first vast fortunes. Combative, unhappy in his family life, and obsessed with contacting the dead as an old man, Vanderbilt seems an unlikely icon of American success. Yet Stiles contends that Vanderbilt did more than any other individual to shape the economic world we live in today. What business innovations, including the modern corporation, did he create? How did he deal with his competitors? What did President Lincoln ask of him during the Civil War? How did he become the figurehead for America's manifest destiny? These are some of the questions Stiles addresses as he leads us in a consideration of the first tycoon. T.J. Stiles has held the Gilder Lehrman Fellowship in American History at the Dorothy and Lewis B. Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library. He's taught at Columbia University and served as an advisor for the PBS series The American Experience. His first book, Jesse James, The Last Rebel of the Civil War, won the Ambassador Book Award and the Peter Seaborg Award for Civil War Scholarship and was a New York Times notable book. Welcome to Cambridge Forum, T.J. Stiles.
Thank you very much. It's a real honor to be invited to speak here because in San Francisco, I listen to the local public radio station KQED, and every weekend they broadcast the Cambridge Forum, and you do a terrific job with this program, so it's a real honor to be here, and thank you for coming out tonight. Now, I'm going to speak just very briefly so that we can have an exchange and talk about the things that you're specifically interested in, because there's no way I could really cover Vanderbilt's life even if I had the entire hour. This is someone who was born during George Washington's presidency, who went to work before the War of 1812, and lived long enough to make deals personally with John D. Rockefeller. His life was woven throughout the main currents of American history, through national events, through international events. Someone who personally knew every president from John Quincy Adams, whom he was in a train wreck with in 1833, in a three-car train, so they probably knew each other on the train, through the end of the presidency of Ulysses S. Grant, whom he also knew personally, and someone who was involved in international diplomacy, international conflicts, domestic policy, great economic crises, who was present wherever you look in the 19th century. I just want to speak briefly, though, about one incident in his life that suggests how important he was and why, in many ways, his life is relevant today. Historians hate to draw lessons from the past, but certainly his life is and his career is very resonant with what's happening right now. Now, the incident that I'll just take a couple of minutes to describe, just one of many dramatic moments in his life, took place in September 1869. In 1863, as a little background to this, Vanderbilt turned from steamships. He'd spent his long career in steamboats and steamships, becoming the foremost maritime entrepreneur in American history to that date, sold off all his ships at the age of 70, and turned to railroads. And during the 1860s, he progressively took over the railroads that connected New York City with the West. And by 1869, he controlled the railroads that he at that moment was in the process of consolidating into the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad, what I think is probably the ancestor, the pioneering giant corporation in American history. And it ran from Lower Manhattan all the way to Buffalo in the West. So this was a great development in corporate history, a great development in transportation history, building a very low-cost, efficient transportation network that also brought himself great wealth. But at that time, the most important corridor of commerce, channel of commerce, was between Chicago and the great seaports in the east. So a connection from Buffalo to Chicago was extremely important. So in September 1869, Vanderbilt faced a conundrum. As he tried to get at least influence and healthy relations with the railroads to the west, he faced an opponent. The opponent's name was Jay Gould. Jay Gould was one of the last and most troublesome of the many enemies in Cornelius Vanderbilt's life. And the two men were exact opposites. Vanderbilt was 6 feet tall, athletic, a fierce competitor, someone who got involved in fistfights as a young man, and even into his 80s would engage in high-speed harness races on the roads of Upper Manhattan. Gould was small, slender, had a huge black beard, liked to putter around in his garden and collect books. They were complete opposites, but they were very well matched when it came to wits and wiliness in business battle. And Gould controlled the Erie Railroad, the other major railroad that ran west from New York City. And he needed a connection to Chicago. So the two men began to struggle behind the scenes for control of a newly merged railroad that stretched from Chicago to Buffalo. We'll just call it the Lakeshore and Michigan Southern Railway. Vanderbilt bought a lot of stock in the company, put his son-in-law on the board, but his son-in-law soon found he had an opponent on the board of the Lakeshore. The man's name was LeGrand Lockwood. He's kind of short, kind of fat. Unlike Vanderbilt, he'd spent his long career on Wall Street, very much accepted by New York's high society, went to Europe every year and collected fine art, was a treasurer of the New York Stock Exchange. And Lockwood had suffered in business combat with Vanderbilt in the past. And Lockwood made an alliance with Gould. They sealed the deal with a fine dinner at Delmonico's in Lower Manhattan, where Jim Fisk, Jay Gould's flamboyant partner, played the entertainer. And they made an agreement to divert the traffic from the lakeshore from Chicago over the Erie rather than over Vanderbilt's railroad. And they made other plans that would have injured Vanderbilt's interests. Well, Vanderbilt was a man who had seen a lot of business combat over the years. So he was patient. He bided his time. He understood the unseen architecture of American commerce that was emerging in the 19th century. The rise of an abstract financial world that was new for Americans at that time. A world of credit markets, financial markets, securities, corporations, things that had no tangible corporeal existence. It was something that was at the heart of a cultural as well as economic debate in America in the 19th century. A lot of businessmen really had trouble grasping this sort of abstract world that was a step removed from the tangible world of what we now call the real economy. Vanderbilt understood it very well. So he waited until September of 1869 when the credit markets started to grow tight. America was an agricultural country. In the fall, the crops in the West were harvested and shipped to seaport for export. Reserve accounts, deposits in New York banks were drawn down as merchants and farmers in the West needed to get cash to be able to handle all the transactions for the harvest, what they called the moving of the crops. And on Wall Street, stock trading began to suffer at that time of year when the credit markets started to dry up. So Vanderbilt waited until the moving of the crops began. Then, secretly, because there were no reporting requirements at that time, through multiple brokers, he issued contracts for the sale of stock in Lakeshore stock, of which he owned vast amounts. Well, Lockwood, as he knew, had borrowed millions of dollars to buy on margin, that is on credit, millions of dollars worth of Lakeshore stock, Lockwood counting on his alliance with Gould to drive up the shares of Lakeshore, Vanderbilt secretly selling vast amounts, reserving to himself the right to decide when to deliver the stock. Once the moving of the crops begins, the credit market starts to tighten up, stock trading is beginning to slow down, prices are beginning to hesitate. Then all in one day, actually three successive days, in one big blow, delivers all of his stock. Stock price collapsed. The heavily leveraged Lockwood was driven into bankruptcy. He apparently went to Vanderbilt's brownstone mansion in the Washington Square neighborhood and begged for mercy, and Vanderbilt sent him away. And Lockwood, one of the great powers on Wall Street, was driven into bankruptcy. Vanderbilt then took a large loan from Baring Brothers, the British bank, bought back all of the stock that he had sold at reduced prices, bought back all of Lockwood's stock, which is his brokers had sold when he couldn't make his margin calls. All of the stock had gone into the market. The prices had collapsed. He not only crushed his enemy, drove him into bankruptcy, from which he never recovered. He not only got control of the railroad, absolute control, he also made a fortune by engaging in this operation in which he dropped the price of the company and then bought it back at a lower price. So it was a brilliant operation. However, the problem is that it contributed to one of the great panics on Wall Street, Black Friday of 1869. Vanderbilt also knew that Jay Gould was engaged in a complex operation to corner the gold market, and that that was creating a frenzy on Wall Street, and that there was great strife and trouble as people were caught up in this Gould's attempt to corner the gold market. I won't go into the details, but he knew that the Wall Street was in peril at that moment. He knew that it was vulnerable. He knew that it was a critical moment, and yet he gambled essentially the health of the entire financial system on his ability to step in and rescue Wall Street from this panic. When Black Friday occurred, the gold market collapsed, and Vanderbilt contributed to it by crushing stock prices and driving down stock prices. Vanderbilt then stepped in, did something he rarely did. He went to Wall Street himself. At 75 years old, he strolls down onto the stock exchange. Brokers gather around him. One broker said to a reporter, "I knew it, I knew it. The old rat never forgets his friends." And he began to very publicly make a big show of buying stock. Of course, he bought stock, outstanding stock in his own railroads, driving the price up. He arrested the fall of the market, managed to stop the panic, and brought prices back up again. And as I put in the book, this moment shows Vanderbilt both at his most daring, at his most skillful in the financial markets that even some of his contemporaries did not yet understand. And at the same time, it's chilling. This is a man who, in pursuing his own private interests, knowingly pushed the entire economy to the brink, gambling on his ability to arrest the fall and bring it back. And as I put it in the book, the American public was very lucky that he gambled so skillfully and was able to carry out the rescue operation as successfully as he carried out the punishment side of the operation. And that is the conundrum of Vanderbilt, this man who pursued his own private interests but had grown to such power, had grown to such a prominent place in the American economy that his private interests intersected with the public interests. And when he engaged in vast public enterprises, he contributed, there's no doubt that he contributed enormously to the wealth of the American economy, to the growth of the American economy, to the geographical expansion of the United States. And yet, as those enterprises grew in size, his private interests had, and the way he carried them out and pursued them, had vast public repercussions. Now, I'm not going to give you any lessons. We're going to throw open the floor to questions soon. I'm not going to draw any neat and simple lessons for the present, not at all. And it's not even my job to condemn or praise Vanderbilt. The point is that his life not only was about the rise of this financial and economic system we have today, but it also illustrated for Americans then, as we're seeing now, this conundrum where the pursuit of private interests creates great good and great wealth, and yet at the same time, it creates these complications which are very hard to solve, and that right now we're in the midst of a great crisis trying to figure out how to solve our current intersection of private interests and public interest. So he may have died in 1877, but I find his life to be, if anything, more relevant than at any point when I was working on the book, having no idea at the end it would be as relevant as it is right now. So at that point, I would like to defer to the moderator, and hopefully we'll have some good questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, TJ. Thank you for the presentation. I just want to remind everyone that you're joining us at Cambridge Forum as we continue our discussion with TJ Styles, whose new biography of Cornelius Vanderbilt is entitled The First Tycoon, and it examines the epic life of this 19th century businessman in the context of the development of American capitalism. I'll ask the first question. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the myths that have sort of come up around Vanderbilt? There's sort of lots of myths about who he was, what he was about, and I think in your book you kind of prick the balloons with some of these myths.
That's a good question because there were so many that surrounded him. And there's a couple of reasons why he is so enshrouded in myth, I think. For example, one of the main reasons is that there has not been a serious biography, really well-researched biography of Vanderbilt since 1942, when Wheaton Lane published a very good biography, which now is, needless to say, it's out of date. And Vanderbilt has then been, for writers about the American past, he's always been a secondary character who adds color to the story. Nobody's really taken him on and looked at him in depth. He's always been a very useful character for someone writing about, say, Victoria Woodhull or someone else, that here's this colorful background figure that makes my story a little more colorful. But also the press at the time contributed to it. The press in the 19th century was very quick to report rumors. It was very quick to even concoct things. Vanderbilt's obituaries are the source of a lot of myths. There are stories there that are just complete nonsense that papers like the New York Times would publish. And I have no idea where they got this stuff. But one of the reasons why Vanderbilt has so many myths about him is that he was a colorful figure. But he didn't leave a lot of public record. I was able to find a lot of stuff, but only by working on this book for over 6 years. And he was somebody who kept his mouth shut and did a lot of his business in secret, and it's very easy to make up stuff about a guy like that. So, for example, some of the myths that I debunk, probably the most important is that he had nothing to do with the invention of the potato chip. So, I'm sorry. not connected to Cornelius Vanderbilt at all. Some of the other myths let me just take one other one. The myth that he was this illiterate, crude man who was never accepted by New York society. Now, like a lot of myths, there's a little kernel of truth to that, in the sense that he was born very poor. He was a sailor's young man who got involved in fistfights. And in the research I did over at the Baker Library at the Harvard Business School, the early credit reports from the R.G. Dunn and Company, which reported on businessmen for other businessmen, the very first report says, when Vanderbilt was in his 50s, from 1853, said he's boorish and illiterate, he's crude and uncultured, and offensive. They called him offensive. When he moved from Staten Island to Manhattan, they had a public jubilee to celebrate his leaving Staten Island. Then, by the end of his life, when he was much richer, the report said he's a high-toned and honorable gentleman. So what a difference $100 million makes. But there's also a reason for that. Later report, Vanderbilt had, and he developed, much more dignity than he had early in life. And he was described by newspaper reporters as being gentlemanly and courteous. And in business combat, he could still be ferocious. But he in the end, he was accepted by New York society, and he really sort of filled out this role of the great merchant prince that he saw for himself. So the relationship with high society is a case where it was much more complex than the myth has it. And that occurs again and again.
Why did it take more than 60 years for another biography to come along of Vanderbilt?
Historians, I think, are a lot like, and I say this with all due respect, they're a lot like the story of the drunk who drives home and pulls into the driveway and drops his keys, and he goes over and starts looking for his keys around the front door because that's where the light is better. And there are a lot of very important figures in American history who do not have good biographies because there's no big collection of papers. So if you go through, especially the more academic publications each year, there are huge volumes about people you've never heard of because they leave really good, juicy collections of papers, and it's easy to sit in one archive and go through their papers and produce a book. And Vanderbilt is somebody who I had to be lucky, resourceful, and a real grind, and just find stuff and follow up side leads that I thought would lead nowhere, and sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they led to wonderful material, And, you know, it was just a matter of putting in year after year and watching my 401ks disappear and things like that. And so that's why. Just no easy collection of papers. Stuff was scattered everywhere.
Great. Again, you're listening to author T.J. Stiles discussing The First Tycoon, his new biography of Cornelius Vanderbilt. At this stage, I think we'll open it up to the floor and take questions from the audience. So if you have a question, why don't we line up here in front of the microphone, and you can ask T.J. your question about Vanderbilt. Who will be our first? Here we go. We have a volunteer.
First of all, congratulations on the wonderful review, both in the Times and the Globe, so we really appreciate that. My question has to do with the, I don't know what to put it into, but the how did a man like Vanderbilt think of himself in a competitive edge? Did he just think that because he was there, he could do anything he wanted? Or did he have ever have any interior constraints that were came as a result of a moral conscience or lack of moral conscience? I know that might be putting you into a position which you don't want to do, which is to take lessons. But what I'm trying to do is to put you within the context of the way in which he perceived himself, and the way in which his competitors in business perceived themselves at that time. And how did he see this world that he participated in? Did he never have anything that would give him any kind of sense of constraints that he was doing too much?
That's an interesting question, because Vanderbilt has often been depicted as this purely amoral creature who was willing to do anything, basically. And he's often been conflated and confused with a lot of his rivals. For example, in the famous Erie War of 1868, the most famous of the Gilded Age Wall Street battles, in which he fought with Daniel Drew and Jay Gould and Jim Fisk over the control of the Erie Railway, there was a lot of corruption of government officials. And when I started writing the book, I assumed that Vanderbilt was bribing away with the best of them. And it turns out I could not find any evidence or even any accusations at the time that Vanderbilt was bribing people. And I thought that was kind of interesting, because he was ruthless. He took extraordinary steps to defeat his enemies. And I think for much of his career, at least until he got into the railway years, he saw his enterprises as much as military campaigns against his enemies as he did machinery and enterprise and businesses, which makes his life a lot of fun to read about, but raises questions about whether he did have a code. And surprisingly, he really did have a code of conduct. Now, his opponents didn't always agree, but he really polished his reputation as a man of his word. And I found letters from people he dealt with in which they would say, well, let's have a written agreement. And he said, no, you know that my word is as good as my bond. And often when he had disputes, he almost always suggested that they go to arbitration. You know, each side picks an arbitrator, and then those two arbitrators pick a third. And when his opponents agreed, he almost always won, which tells you something. He would push his opponents as hard as possible, but once he made a deal, he stuck to it. Another thing that's interesting about Vanderbilt, and again, I'm saying this not, you know, trying to raise him up as a great hero and trying to make some statement about the free enterprise system, how it's the best system in the world, which happens with 19th century figures. People want to prove a point. Now, looking at him on his own terms, what the evidence shows is that he was not only honest, but he also believed in his duty to his stockholders. And as he became a corporate official, he really believed that he had a duty, as he put it, to run a corporation as if it was his own personal private property. So what he did was invest heavily in the stock, and in the 19th century, stock was expected to pay dividends. They didn't look for growth in share value. They looked for steady dividends. That's what investors look for then. So he took no salary, and the only remuneration he took was dividends in his stock. A lot of corporate officials engaged in side dealing, and Andrew Carnegie's mentors at the Pennsylvania Railroad are much more like the the executives we have now at corporations. They were not major shareholders. They were professional managers hired by you know, these largely anonymous shareholders who run the company. Very smart men. Thomas A. Scott, Jagger Thompson. They ran the Pennsylvania Railroad. But they ran it very well, but they also pioneered shell corporations and dummy companies through which they funneled the company's business, and they controlled those companies and skimmed money as it came in and out of the Pennsylvania. Vanderbilt never engaged in that sort of business. He thought it was abhorrent. So surprisingly, for a man who was utterly ruthless, and as I mentioned in my opening remarks, was willing to gamble with the health of the entire country when it suited his own interests, and yet within the context of business, he had a strict code of ethics and he lived by it. And I think that's interesting. Another thing about him is that he was driven by pride. And I think what drove him into railroads when he was 70 years old, well past life expectancy, past when he expected to live, he turned to railroads. He didn't think, I'm going to become the great railroad tycoon. No, he started off with the New York and Harlem Railroad, which at the time was considered the most necrotic company in America. It was a railroad that was considered barely worth the iron in the rails. And he said, you know what, I can take this railroad and I can make it profitable. And he said repeatedly, it was a point of pride for me to take a company where the stock wasn't worth $10 a share and to raise it up and make it into a healthy, profitable company. And that pride drove him. It's why he was such a competitor personally with his, you know, racing horses and other personal card. He was a card player, fierce competitor at everything he did. And that personal pride was really something that drove him all the way through. And that, of course, also made him such a ferocious competitor with his enemies, too. Next question, please.
excuse me, is it true that he was famously greedy in the sense that he, even toward the end of his life, with you know, being an extremely wealthy person, he did not care to share at all in any public charities or any, you know, causes of goodwill? And I was wondering if his descendants perhaps, you know, changed that course as the Rockefellers did.
That's a good question. His relationship to charity and how benevolent he was. During much of his life, he was considered notably unbenevolent. But there's a couple, and I don't completely dismiss that idea. Certainly, he was no Andrew Carnegie. He didn't engage in some of the truly great philanthropy that later tycoons did. There's no doubt about that. On the other hand, there's two things to remember about Vanderbilt. One is that he hated people who were boastful and talked about themselves. And there are a lot of reports that are impossible to verify that claim that he engaged in a lot of charity, but he just refused to put his name out there. And he would, certainly I do know that, for example, young relatives, nephews and grandsons, you know, their letters to presidents and whatnot, where he'd say, you know, I normally don't do this, but I really hope that you can help him out and I would like you to find a position for this guy. You know, he engaged in helping people out much more than the public record would indicate, I think. The other thing is that he was a man who was deeply patriotic. And a lot of the benevolence that he did take part in, and again, I don't want to exaggerate it, though it was sizable relative to his estate, it was not so sizable. But he, for example, during the Civil War, donated his largest steamship worth almost $1 million to the Union Navy and personally outfitted it and then re-outfitted it for the Union. He took part in helping to prepare major expeditions without any pay. He engaged in these activities because he was deeply patriotic. He named his three sons after his heroes, George Washington, William Henry Harrison, and Cornelius Vanderbilt. So he was, like I said, he was a proud man. But then after the Civil War, he really took on the idea of helping to reconcile North and South. And so he put up his name as one of the bondsmen for Jefferson Davis to get him out of prison. He specifically wanted to help found a university in the South, deliberately to counterbalance his gift to the Union Navy. And those two gifts largely balance each other. He actually gave slightly more money to found Vanderbilt University. So it's true. He will not go down in history as one of the great charitable givers, but the record, I think, needs to be balanced a little bit, and also specifically to be seen as his personal vision of trying to reconcile the two sides of the country. Rather than being, you know, I'm going to found libraries, he thought, let's try to bring the divided country together again.
I was wondering if you could shed some light on his activities during 1837 to 1841, when the country was mired in a deep recession. It would have been during his formative business years and building shipping. If you could just kind of expound on some of the themes and activities during that period and how perhaps he took advantage of the downturn in the economy.
Yeah, sure. For people who aren't aware, this was the period after the second great panic in American history. And the country was in a deep depression after 1837. And these were years in which Vanderbilt had just launched into, appropriately enough, the transportation routes between New York and Boston. When the Industrial Revolution had taken off, and New York was the great shipping center and commercial and financial center in the country, and Boston was the capital of the new textile factory zones in the Northeast. And again, he had a real knack. One of the secrets of his success was an unerring sense for where the main channel of commerce was in the country. Now, I mentioned at the beginning, late in life, Chicago to New York, during this period, the 1830s and 40s, between New York and Boston. And he ran his steamboats on Long Island Sound and ran in connection with the railroads, which there wasn't enough capital to build a railroad all the way to New York, so they ran short lines down to the seaport towns on Long Island Sound. Well, one of the interesting things is that Vanderbilt always had a large cash reserve when these panics hit. He always managed to see trouble coming soon enough so that he wasn't overexposed in terms of being overly leveraged. Another thing is that by constantly engaging in fare wars with his opponents, he kept prices on his steamboats very low. And that, I think, had a surprising effect. In the 19th century, before the Civil War, paper money, which is what most people used for most transactions, was issued by private banks. And the banks would collect a reserve of gold and silver, which was, you know, gold or silver coin was worth its weight in that precious metal. You could melt it down and sell it for the same amount. And they would issue loans by issuing paper money. And they would keep a larger amount of paper. And you could presumably go back to the bank and say, you know what, give me gold. And there would be a larger amount of paper money in circulation than the bank actually had a reserve in gold and silver. Well, what happens during a depression is that everybody rushes back to the bank, wants their gold, the banks stop redeeming their paper bank notes, and anyone's left holding these paper bank notes ends up holding nothing. Well, most paper bank notes were only issued for larger denominations, a dollar or larger, usually $5 or larger. Vanderbilt's fares were usually a dollar or less often. So he had gold and especially silver coin, which never lost its value. So ironically, on a lot of his routes, the low fares actually ended up giving him a large cash reserve. This wasn't always the case, but it's one of those little financial side effects of his businesses. And yes, he did. He seized upon the weaknesses of his opponents, who were often overexposed. He would take advantage of their being overexposed, overly in debt, and he would hammer them by undercutting them in fares. And he was incredibly effective at doing things like getting cheaper fuel. He designed his steamships himself. He was one of the great maritime architects of the paddle wheel era. And the steamboats he started to put on Long Island Sound were written up in technical journals as masterpieces of naval engineering. His first great Long Island Sound steamboat used half the fuel of its rival steamboats, and fuel was by far the largest expense. So these sorts of things, his ability to cut costs, were phenomenal. And one thing that I touch on in the book, and I won't go into great detail, is that his attacks on especially early corporations and on companies that had monopolies, legal or otherwise, played right into a big political conflict in the 19th century in which an economy in which there weren't large businesses, the economy is relatively flat. Laissez-faire was a radical philosophy. And corporations were seen as grants of special favors to men who are already rich, giving them limited liability and other special privileges. And so Vanderbilt's business enterprises during the 1830s and 40s were actually raised him up as a kind of Jacksonian populist hero. Here's this guy who's an individual going after these rich corporations that have special privileges granted by the government. And Vanderbilt knew this, and he paid attention to politics, even though he wasn't a partisan himself. And he made public pronouncements saying, you know, I'm the anti-monopoly guy. He called his lines the people's line. You know, his headline said, no monopoly, you know, power to the people, or sort of the equivalent. And in his early career, he was a radical. He was a populist. Now, his laissez-faire philosophy stayed the same as he became the great railroad tycoon, and he's the master of these giant corporations. And the political world, as I put it, the political landscape rotated 180 degrees. So he's saying to the paper, listen, you know, like saying the same things he'd said in the 1830s when he got into the 1870s. And meanwhile, the first government regulation advocates are out there, and the populace all of a sudden are favoring government intervention. So it's very interesting when we look at today's political landscape. And I think a lot of liberals don't understand how people earning $30,000 a year with a family of five can be pro-free market and anti-government regulation. But when you look at the currents of American history, a lot of these currents are very deep. They go back very far. And there's a lot of complex interweaving of these threads in American political philosophy and beliefs. And sometimes things that confuse people today make sense if you follow them back and you see that there are these very deep currents in American history. We have very contradictory values in this country. And even the same person can have contradictory beliefs about equality and opportunity. And these things come up in Vanderbilt's life again and again. It's one of the reasons why I think he's so influential. It's not just that he built businesses, but that, you know, he played a part in the making of our contradictory values.
Another question?
Right here. Was he active in any church?
That's a good question. No. No, he actually was notoriously unreligious. And he was raised in the Moravian church. Some Vanderbilt ancestor had switched from Dutch Reformed to Moravian. And he was capable of, you know, personal charity, and he would occasionally express things in religious terms. But I don't know if he ever went to a church except for a wedding or a funeral. But late in life, his second wife, was very religious. And he did give money. She was a Methodist. And he did give money to found Vanderbilt University, which was specifically a religious university. And he did give money to buy a church for the Church of the Strangers, which was a church for Southerners in New York City. But interestingly, when he made those gifts, he didn't ask the bishop who was the first head of Vanderbilt University or the minister who ran the church that he endowed. He didn't ask them about their religious beliefs. He couldn't care less about theology. As he said to one of them after he'd been preaching to Vanderbilt for a while in the hot summer heat, waving a fan, he said, "Doctor, everything you've said to me weighs about as much with me as that fan you're waving right now." He didn't care about religious beliefs. But he did care about people, and he wanted to make sure that those men were honest and capable. So he questioned them extensively, but about what they were like as men. That's what he knew from life and business. Then from his wife's diary, his second wife's diary, when he was on his deathbed and had a horrible several months of his body beginning to fail, suffering terrible internal infections, he finally asked toward the end of his very end of his life, you know, he asked her to take part in a prayer with him and said he wanted to give his life to Jesus. And she said, "Well, is it because you love Jesus or you're afraid of going to hell?" He said, "Well, you know, to be honest, both, really." And he was a man of few words, but he was honest up to the very end, which is one of his redeeming qualities.
Someone else in the back? Good.
I'm capable of going on at length, so please, you better ask.
Hi, thanks for your talk. You preface your book with a quote, "To understand just one life, you have to swallow the world." I just wondered what about that quotation inspired you, by Salman Rushdie. And on the flip side of that question is, you alluded in the introduction to some advice that he lent Abraham Lincoln. Can you expand on that chapter?
Sure, absolutely. First question, I'm a great admirer of Midnight's Children. I haven't read everything Rushdie's read, but this is one of my favorite books. And that quote really stuck in my head as I worked on this. You know, I remember when I turned in the first few chapters to my editor, and I thought, "Oh, hooray, I'm gotten going on this." And he just sent him back with another, like, "This is just not, you can do way better than this." I was just crushed. And I realized that I was just writing about his business. I wasn't writing about how it fit into the world in which he existed. And the turning point in his early life, for example, he took on his only employer he ever had in his life, a man who was really his mentor. It was a man named Thomas Gibbons. And he's the man who hired Vanderbilt to work on his first steamboat, and he became a steamboat captain, and brought him into this great legal as well as business battle against a monopoly, a legal monopoly that New York State had given to the Livingston family for steamboats in New York waters. And it led to Gibbons v. Ogden, the first Commerce Clause case that the Supreme Court decided, and a legal landmark to this day, in which the Supreme Court said states cannot erect boundaries of trade. We have a free market, basically, in the United States. Only Congress can control interstate trade. And it really is one of the keys to America's economic growth. And Vanderbilt, by the way, was keenly interested in this, went himself to hear the arguments, hired Webster, Daniel Webster, himself when he was a young man with no very little education. And as I started to look into this, I realized it's not even about law. It's not just about business. It is about the end of an 18th century culture of deference, in which you had old landed aristocratic families, especially in New York, which they had mercantilist ideas. They expected to be granted special privileges, and they sort of would take custody of the American economy in the way in which they had custody of politics and of other areas of life. And New York State at the time, for example, had not only property requirements, they had two separate levels of property requirements. You had to have a high level to vote for governor and a lower level to vote for the state assembly. So it was this hierarchical society. And I realized that this era of Vanderbilt's life is not just about him getting ahead, meeting the right guy. It's not just about this legal battle. It was about the end of this older hierarchical society and the birth of an individualistic, competitive society, much more like the one we know today. And so that experience of having to go back and rewrite those early chapters really made me realize that, you know, this is an important life, but it's important because it's woven into so many other areas other than just business, other than even just politics, you know, culture and society and all these things. And so as I wove them in, you know, it's a long book. I cut out a lot more, believe me. I'm trying to keep all of that focus so that you know as the reader what you need to know to go ahead, so that you want to find out what happens next. That was the challenge as the writer. As the historian, you know, really, you know, we have to understand this stuff and you know, the surrounding context. So the business battle isn't just dramatic, but it's significant. And then as the writer, trying to really keep up the momentum to make sure you want to turn the page, that was the challenge as the writer, which I tried to impart into this book. So that's the answer to that question. The second question was about Lincoln. Oh, yeah, more specifically. There's a great incident in Vanderbilt's life which involved the Confederate ironclad, the Merrimack, or the Virginia. And we all know the story about how this ironclad chuffs out of Norfolk Harbor, sinks a bunch of Union ships. Everybody's in a panic. Fortunately, the Monitor, the Union ironclad, had just been finished, steams onto the scene the next day, battles the Merrimack to a standstill. Hooray, the day is saved for the Union Navy. Well, as I point out in my book, the Merrimack, it was a draw. And so the Merrimack was still there. And if the Monitor had just had a mechanical breakdown, pretty common in a new ship, then they would have felt completely helpless. So there are all these letters to the White House and to Secretary of War Stanton saying, you know, we need something. And so Stanton sent a telegram to Vanderbilt saying, can you provide a ship that can help us fight the Merrimack? And so he'd been trying for the first few months of the war to give his largest steamship, which he named the Vanderbilt, to the Union Navy. And the Secretary of the Navy didn't want it, in part, I think, because Gideon Welles was kind of a proud guy, and he didn't want, you know, this rich guy telling him that, you know, he should have his ship. But this led Lincoln himself to say, can you help us? And he rushed to Washington. He spoke to Lincoln. Lincoln said, can you help us? And he said, yes, I'm going to give you for free my largest steamship. And not only that, I'll outfit it personally to fight the Merrimack, and I'll bring it down myself. And interestingly, Lincoln gave him complete power to do whatever he wanted to with the Merrimack, or with the Vanderbilt. Outfit it how he wanted, officer it as he wanted, deploy it as he wanted. And Vanderbilt fitted it out with a ram in a few days, brought it down to Hampton Roads, and then he talked to the naval officers on the scene, decided, you know, I don't need to, you know, these guys can handle it, they know what they're doing. And it played a key part in bottling up the Merrimack, and there's letters from the Confederate officers saying they were very worried about the Vanderbilt running down the Merrimack. And so it didn't engage in battle, but it played a key role in bottling up the Merrimack and allowing the Union campaign to go ahead. Then later he outfitted it again as a cruiser to hunt for the Confederate commerce raider, the Alabama. And so there's a great little kind of long-distance duel between Vanderbilt and Raphael Semmes, the captain of the Alabama, who wanted revenge against Vanderbilt for sending a ship against him, and he deliberately targeted Vanderbilt's steamship line to try to get revenge. And there's some great little incidents where he chases after Vanderbilt's ships on the high seas. And there's some other stuff, too. He was very involved for a couple of years in the Union war effort, again, taking no remuneration. That's sort of Vanderbilt at his best. Lincoln asked the Congress to give him a Congressional Gold Medal in thanks, which they did.
Another question?
You've talked a lot about how we perceive Vanderbilt's legacy, but how did he perceive his legacy? And particularly, how did his, you know, family, his dynasty, fit into his perception of success?
Thank you for asking. That's the one thing that we haven't talked about much is his family. And that's a really interesting story that I tried to pay a lot of attention to, is that personal side and that family side of the story, which shows Vanderbilt at his worst, as you know, not entirely worst, but, you know, I just mentioned Vanderbilt at his best. When it came to his family, that's often when he was at his worst. And how did he see himself? There was an interesting incident in 1867 when he, in a battle between his railroads and before he took control of the New York Central, he famously, in the depth of winter, when boats couldn't get through the frozen harbor to Manhattan, he, to settle a dispute with the New York Central Railroad, he cut off access of all trains from the west into New York City, essentially personally levied a blockade on the nation's largest city. This created a bit of a furor. It won him his battle with the New York Central, but it created a furor, and the New York State Legislature started to talk about laws they could pass to control this. And the way he responded when he gave testimony is very interesting. He didn't say that, you know, the law is no good, et cetera. He didn't talk about the public interest. He said, if you can pass a law that will compel men to pursue their interests more intelligently than their interests themselves will compel them, then it's all well and good. But I don't think you can do that. In other words, he deeply believed that basically in the invisible hand, without ever having read Adam Smith, I'm sure he didn't, he believed that the world is run by everybody pursuing their private interests to the best of their ability. Now, he had a business code. He thought you should do it honestly, fiercely, but honestly. But he really believed things function when everybody pursues their own interests. So that's how he saw his legacy. He didn't see himself as, you know, he didn't think about the public interest. He thought the public interest, he said, I've served the public to the best of my ability. Why? Because it's in my interest to do so. That's what he said. So he saw himself as a man who, if he served the public, fine, but it's because I'm pursuing my own private interests. So to that extent, you know, it's, again, as I mentioned at the very beginning, a problematic and ambivalent legacy that he left, even in his own terms. Now, with his family, you know, he had a total of 13 children, 11 of whom lived through adulthood, and he had a vast fortune when he died. 1877, it was estimated, and it's hard to know for sure, at $100 million. Now, I don't give equivalent modern figures in the book because I don't think that's an honest way to do it, but I do look at the Comptroller of the Currency's report on how much money was in circulation. And if you look at the amount of money in circulation, if he had been able to sell all his assets of that estimated $100 million to American buyers, he would have taken, including cash and demand deposits, one out of every $20 in circulation. Now, if Bill Gates, back in September, when Forbes calculated his fortune at $58 billion, I think, could have done the same thing, and you take the Federal Reserve's M2 figure, which I won't go into, he would have taken one out of every $138. So the difference between the disparity in wealth is pretty obvious, and that probably understates the disparity for various reasons. And plus, you've got the power that control of railroads gave Vanderbilt. You know, there's no industry that overshadows the entire economy the way that railroads did at that time. So it was a vast fortune. And the money he left to his widow and to his various daughters were large amounts at the time. $500,000 he left to his wife and to some of his daughters, not all. And that was enough for you to be very wealthy, extremely wealthy in the 19th century, even the late 19th century. But he left 95% of his estate to his oldest son. And why? Well, first of all, he thought his oldest son was capable. He'd brought William H. Vanderbilt in as his operational manager, and he did a very good job. But because he deliberately wanted to perpetuate his name, the name that he had given to his steamboats and to his steamships, the name that he had given to his son, his second son, who unfortunately was a gambling addict and epileptic. And so he left all this money to one son, deliberately trying to found a dynasty. And it bitterly divided his family. Now, Vanderbilt is more complicated as a family man than, again, the myth is that he was this brutal tyrant who just abused his wife and his children hated him. And that's not true. He was a hard man. He was very judgmental. He reminds me of a friend of mine who said that his father once told him when he was young, you know, I'm never going to let you beat me at anything. If we ever play a game, you're going to have to beat me on your own. And that's tough for a kid. You respect a father like that, but when you're growing up, it's not a lot of fun either. And that's the way it was for Vanderbilt. Sometimes some famous incidents in which he was hard on his family, I think, are overblown, but that doesn't make them nice. For example, his first wife in 1846, he put her in an insane asylum for a while. Now, when you look at the testimony about that, it turns out that, you know, she was having serious problems, and a son-in-law who, you know, generally had unfavorable feelings by the time he spoke about this, about Vanderbilt, thought actually it was justified. She needed medical help, and an asylum was the way to do it. So it was a tough thing to do, but it wasn't, you know, a brutal tyrant. It was sort of like, what do we do? She's just not herself. She's acting weird. Now, he also used that time perhaps to pursue a young governess who was in the household. So again, you know, this is overblown. Maybe this part isn't. He again, was not a nice man. And he was hard on his daughters. He was hard on his second son, Kernille, the one who was a gambling addict. But then again, Kernille would have tried any father's patience. He was someone who was always in trouble with the law, skipping out on his bills, involved in bad debts, addicted to gambling, boastful, all the things his father wasn't. And I sort of use him as the anti-hero in the book because it's this troubled son brings out all the emotional complexity in Vanderbilt. The stern judge, the overbearing father who sometimes is harsh on his son and had him arrested and sent to an insane asylum also, at a time when they had no way of dealing with addiction. They did not have the language for addiction. So again, a hard thing to do, but understandable in the context. And sometimes, you know, encouraging and loving. His first wife said his attitude toward that son was stubborn inconsistency, which is, you know, not nice, but it's human. It's understandable. So in clearing up the record about Vanderbilt as a family man, I by no means depict him as a nice and sweet father, but he's human and complicated and more sympathetic at various points, not all the way through, but at various points than I think he's been given credit for in the past. And so that it doesn't make him into an admirable man, but he makes him into a character that you can understand. And then as you follow him through his personal life as well as his business life, he's a more sympathetic character than I think we've realized. And that's not to take away any of the complications and ambivalence personally or historically. But, you know, again, that's the American experience. You know, we have this economy which is incredibly productive and yet raises you know, real questions that we're struggling with now. And, you know, questions like addiction and mental illness are things that, you know, most families deal with at some point. And these are things that are woven through Vanderbilt's life. And as he struggled to deal with them, he didn't always deal with them very well, but he did struggle to deal with them. And it gives the story sometimes a contemporary relevance and resonance that I didn't anticipate. But his son, and then his primary successor, his grandson Cornelius Vanderbilt Jr., or Vanderbilt II, you know, they lived into their 50s and died. And so William H. Vanderbilt was given credit for doubling the family fortune in a few years. I think that actually, if Vanderbilt himself had done nothing but kind of let his estate compound, and he'd lived as long as his son, it probably would have been similar. As he put it, the New York Central Railroad could run itself after a certain point. But the interesting thing about William H. Vanderbilt is that he deserves a lot of credit as a business manager, but he was never kind of the Napoleonic figure that his father was. And he was surprisingly undiplomatic as a businessman. You know, J.P. Morgan bought a large block of stock. He himself didn't. He set up a syndicate that bought a large block of stock in the New York Central Railroad in an attempt to control the destructive competition among railroads. And he was kind of the impresario of what became the Vanderbilt system after the Commodore died. And so he worked closely with William H. Vanderbilt, and he complained continually about how he's always quibbling, he engages in disputes that would embarrass a Bowery lawyer and, you know, a Skid Row lawyer. And he was a quarrelsome figure who was kind of testy. And I've read a lot of other letters complaining about how the son was testy, but he was a nice father. So Vanderbilt, the tough father, was a diplomatic businessman. William, his son, was a terrible business diplomat, but, you know, kind of a nice father. And William really, as soon as his father died, and once he settled this big fight over the will and secured his control of the estate, he sold a controlling block of shares to J.P. Morgan Syndicate and began to build these lavish mansions, as did his children, that his father never would have tolerated. As soon as the old man's dead, boom, up go the huge mansions. And the Gilded Age excess begins, you know, once the sort of tight-fisted old man is gone, then they start building the famous Vanderbilt mansions.
And of course, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the most famous descendant of Cornelius Vanderbilt, Anderson Cooper. Has he commented on the book? Or
no, I haven't contacted him. You know, I know that Vanderbilt himself left no papers behind. And so, to be honest, I didn't harass the family and the descendants. And after, I have been in touch with, I'm actually not sure of what his connection with the main line is. Arthur Vanderbilt II, who wrote a nice book several years ago, Fortune's Children. You know, there have been a few books about the Vanderbilt family. There's no Vanderbilt papers that survive, except the ones that I've uncovered in the book already. So, no, I haven't been in touch with Anderson Cooper. He's a good journalist. And his mother is Gloria Vanderbilt, who's still alive, and I think just has a book out, too, actually.
How many generations removed are they, Gloria and Anderson?
I'm not sure. There's so many. The Vanderbilts went on and on.
That's right. They're direct
descendants. Yes, absolutely, yeah. And again, most of the, if you've heard of any Vanderbilts, they're almost certainly from that one son out of 13 children, William H. Vanderbilt. Now, there are scores of descendants of Commodore Vanderbilt out there, but most of them are descended through these other branches, some of which remained in high society and married into other families and did well. But they didn't, you know, have some giant fortune. And by now, the Vanderbilt fortune has been dissipated because it was founded on the first great industry in America, the railroads, the first industry to mature and fade also. And the New York Central Railroad, you know, was taken over by what are now publicly owned systems. Though the infrastructure Vanderbilt built is still vital to the city of New York. His statue is still out in front of the modern version of Grand Central, the terminal he built. And they still use infrastructure that he constructed, you know, back in the 19th century. It's still very much a vital part of New York today.
Do we have other questions? I'd like to ask one more question, which is the issue of Victoria Woodhull and Tennessee Claflin. How do they factor into, they're definitely not part of the business side of Vanderbilt.
That's one of the many interesting sidelights. A life this long, intersected with a lot of famous and sometimes notorious people. Are people generally familiar with who Victoria Woodhull is? No, it's all right. Victoria Woodhull was one of those interesting kind of footnote, yet more than footnote, characters in 19th century American history. And she, her name came up during the last election because of Hillary's run for the presidency. She famously ran for president in 1872, the first woman to announce herself as a candidate. She was a really fascinating figure, in part because I think she was, in part, a con artist, as well as a brash and effective spokeswoman for women's rights. Excuse me. And she and her sister, Tennessee Claflin, pardon me, were the children of a flim-flam artist who was from the Western states. And they showed up in New York in 1868 and promoted their services as spiritualist mediums and as magnetic healers. And this is a period in American history when spiritualism was huge, and it was a mainstream belief. You have to remember, the Civil War killed the better part of 1 million Americans. Every family had lost loved ones. And spiritualism, you know, having seances, contacting the dead, had gotten its start before the Civil War. But in the decade after the Civil War, it became a huge phenomenon. And Vanderbilt, who outlived so many contemporaries, friends, family, rivals, he started going to seances during the Civil War. And I don't believe that he made any business decisions based on seances. And one of, I think, a telling story, a witness testified to being at a seance with him in which he asked to speak to the ghost of Jim Fisk, one of his rivals. So the medium, you know, contacts, I don't believe in spiritualism. I don't think they actually contacted Jim Fisk. Jim Fisk comes up, oh, Jim Fisk is here. And so Vanderbilt asked him a question about a stock in the stock market. And Jim Fisk, of course, the medium doesn't know anything, so Jim Fisk gives a nonsense answer. And so Vanderbilt doesn't say, oh, that's interesting. He says, what are you talking about? Are you crazy? And he starts to argue with a ghost. They start to have this argument. And then Vanderbilt says, yeah, well, we'll see who's right, you or me. And then he says, starts a joke with Fisk. He says, so how do you like it on the other side? And he says, well, you'll find out soon enough. You're near the end of your line. And they have this hilarious exchange, Vanderbilt arguing and joking with the ghost of Jim Fisk. But it shows that I don't think he made any decisions based on these. I think he found them comforting. I don't think that it was his guide. Now, Victoria Woodhull shows up. She's a magnetic healer. This is an age when doctors use things like bleeding and blistering and mercury. And so he liked his main doctor, but he didn't like his treatments very much. So he would go to magnetic healers. Basically, they do massage. That's basically it. And Tennessee Claflin was a very sexual, Victoria Woodhull's sister, a very sexual woman, and she knew it. And so he kind of liked getting massages from Tennessee Claflin, and he liked the seances that he had with them. And so they became friends of his. And a very interesting development started in 1870 when they suddenly set themselves up as the first female brokers on Wall Street. And they hinted very unsubtly to the press that Vanderbilt was their backer and he was their financial supporter. And, you know, Vanderbilt later said, no, that's not true. But, you know, he didn't make a big show out of it. And so the press reported this. This has gone into American historical mythology that Vanderbilt brought Victoria Woodhull into business and then supported this radical women's rights and spiritualist and sort of catch-all, we would call it New Age today, publication, Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly. And they really set themselves up as this, you know, these kind of radical figures, women's rights figures, you know, and just kind of flamboyant personalities, celebrities. But when I started to look into it, I found that there was really no evidence for Vanderbilt having any business connection with them. And again, those R.G. Dunn & Company reports over at Baker Library, I looked up Victoria Woodhull in those reports. And, you know, they basically said, you know, their brokerage house doesn't do any business at all. It was a publicity stunt. And so, you know, they got a lot of press for it. And there may be Victoria Woodhull biographers in the audience will be mad at me for saying this. But, you know, I think it was just a publicity stunt. They didn't actually do any business with Vanderbilt. And the connection is overblown. And again, the reason it's overblown is because the focus with Vanderbilt has not been on Vanderbilt by historians. It's been on all these other people who cross paths with him. So, you know, the colorful story about Vanderbilt, You know, who wants to look into that? It adds color to my story about Victoria Woodhull or about Jay Gould. But when you look, I started to dig into Vanderbilt's life, I found a lot of these sensational stories started to fall away. He was colorful enough without, you know, the inflated version.
Good. Other questions from the audience? Good, sir.
TJ, can you share with us a little bit about any mention of his heroes, any mistakes that he may have made, or he admitted to, if you will, as well as things he may have wanted to do in his free time in terms of personal hobbies, et cetera? Thank you.
Sure. again, Vanderbilt was deeply patriotic. And I think, you know, in a character who's very contradictory in terms of the way we see him, ambivalent perhaps is a better word, these good and bad sides, his patriotism is probably his best side. And he greatly admired some of the leading statesmen of the day. I think he had admiration for Andrew Jackson, whose philosophy he basically embraced, but he also admired Daniel Webster, a lot of the great Whigs. He was a nonpartisan patriot. The other thing about Vanderbilt that I think is interesting is the way in which he did make mistakes sometimes, and he would learn from them. One of the biggest mistakes he ever made was in his battle against Jay Gould and Jim Fisk and Daniel Drew in the Erie Railway. And the mistake he made was in trusting Daniel Drew. Now, Daniel Drew was another of the robber barons, as we're called. And that's a term that was actually invented, that metaphor was invented for Vanderbilt. So the whole idea of the robber baron began with Vanderbilt. And Daniel Drew was famous as his opponent, but Daniel Drew actually spent almost his entire career as Vanderbilt's secret partner. This is a man who was a financier on Wall Street who was famous for shorting stocks, Daniel Drew, that is. And he would become an officer of a company like the Erie Railway, his treasurer of the Erie Railway, and then he would go out and sell that company's shares short and then deliberately undercut the price of his own company's shares, so that he could then buy back the shares he'd sold and make a profit, you know, destroying the share value of his own company's shares. And the opposite of Vanderbilt's ethics in business. And yet the two were close friends. Now, they were involved in transportation for most of their careers. And what they would do, I found, by finding records that hadn't come to light before, is they would invest in each other's companies so that they would have a reason not to compete against each other. So they were partners, but they made sure that they gave the other guy an incentive. They didn't just trust each other's word. Well, at the end of Vanderbilt's life, he unfortunately trusted Drew's word. And he agreed to kick Drew out of the Erie Railway board in 1867. And then Drew found out about this, and Drew came to him and said, you know, please let me stay on the board. And he said, well, you know, I don't want you undercutting the stock market. It hurts me and my shares in my company. And he said, okay, well, listen, what we'll do is we'll take part together in a campaign to drive up the shares of stock in Erie. And it'll help you, it'll help the money market, everything will be good. So Vanderbilt said, okay. So he changed his deal. Drew got to stay on the board. Drew actually managed a pool of money for some of Vanderbilt's friends, you know, and they were buying Erie shares, prices are rising, everyone's happy. But then meanwhile, secretly, Drew was on his own account secretly selling Erie short. So he's buying for the company and sell, or for the pool, and of Vanderbilt's friends, and then he's selling to the pool short on his own account, and then he uses his position in the Erie Railway to undercut the price, and Vanderbilt was furious. And it led to this huge battle on Wall Street over control of the Erie Railway, which led to Drew and Jay Gould and Jim Fisk being under arrest warrants issued for them, and then the leaders of one of the officers of one of the largest corporations in America scampering onto a ferry and racing to New Jersey to escape the arrest, to Jay Gould showing up in Albany with literally a suitcase full of $100 bills to bribe the legislature. A phenomenal episode. And at the end, Vanderbilt managed to force them to pay back most of his losses. But he had gotten in over his head, and he didn't realize not only could he not trust Drew, but he underestimated Jim Fisk and Jay Gould, a mistake he rarely made, underestimating his opponents. And he is said to have said something. I've never found any evidence that he actually said this, but it certainly captures his opinion of Jay Gould. He said, "It never pays to kick a skunk." I don't think he actually said that, but it's a nice quote, one of those quotes that sticks around because it sums up his attitude. So, you know, that's an example of a mistake he made that he learned from. Another mistake he made, a victory that actually was a defeat, in that one period I haven't talked about very much, in the 1850s, in Vanderbilt switched from northeastern steamboat and railroad lines to steamships. And he pioneered a route to California across Nicaragua. He originally wanted to build a ship canal across Nicaragua. That fell through. That's a whole episode. But he had a transit business across Nicaragua. So he ran steamships down and then steamships on the Pacific up to San Francisco. And it was in competition with the lines that ran to Panama. And there was a railroad that was constructed at Panama. This was actually the main route of traffic between California during the Gold Rush and the East Coast, or the settled states. And successive presidents considered those transit routes in Central America America's number one strategic priority overseas. And so Vanderbilt was very deeply involved with the White House and the State Department and with the British, who claimed a protectorate over eastern Nicaragua. Well, he got out of this business. There are various business battles. He got out, and he bought back in again just as a man named William Walker sailed for Nicaragua. And he was the leading filibuster in the 1850s. And this was a movement of Americans who were trying to seize control of pieces of Latin America to get them annexed to the United States. And Walker actually got himself hired by one of the two sides in Nicaragua's perpetual civil war to fight on their side. And he wasn't a very good general, but just by chance, luck, and one good maneuver, William Walker, who didn't even speak Spanish at the time, won control of Nicaragua. As it just so happened, the leading figures on his side of the Civil War happened to die, and he ended up being the strong man in the Nicaraguan government. So you have this American who doesn't even speak Spanish, who's down there with a bunch of American soldiers, who, through luck and a couple of smart maneuvers, takes control of Nicaragua. Well, just at that moment, Vanderbilt was buying control of the company that ran passengers across Nicaragua. And the San Francisco agent for that company was visited by, and these are papers that have never been seen before, never been published before that I've seen, that a friend of William Walker's shows up, and he says to the San Francisco agent, that's where this gentleman lived also, said, "You know, my friend William Walker just took control of Nicaragua." So Cornelius Garrison, the San Francisco agent, says, "Yes, yeah, I know." He said, "You know, there's good reason for Walker to, destroy the transit company that's carrying passengers." He said, "And once I talk to him, that is, he'll see good reason for it. We're very good friends. And, I think that Walker's a good enough friend that he'll give me the rights to carry passengers across Nicaragua." He said, "Oh, really? Well, you know, I don't have any ships of my own, so I would like to sell those rights to somebody who does have a lot of money and has ships. And perhaps you would be willing to take those rights." And it was basically he was twisting the guy's arm. This political fixer was trying to make a profit off his friend's conquest of Nicaragua, and that's the way it worked out. And he manipulated this guy into betraying Vanderbilt. He didn't realize Vanderbilt was taking control of the company on the other side of the continent. So Vanderbilt, as soon as he buys control of the company, finds out that William Walker has stripped him of the company, seized all the steamboats in Nicaragua and all this business. So an amazing episode develops where Vanderbilt can't get the American government to help him out. He tries the British government. The British government doesn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. So he ends up personally negotiating with the Central American republics on either side, who are very worried about this American, who's getting thousands of recruits coming down who love this idea that an American has taken over a Central American republic. He's got all these American recruits coming. And he's using those steamship lines that have been set up by Vanderbilt's rivals who've betrayed him to bring in recruits. Vanderbilt wants his property back. So he literally sends down secret agents with a crate full of gold and with plans, men who've worked on the route and know the route. And this is an amazing episode. And I've been to the National Archives looking at first-person accounts of this episode. This guy leads a commando raid of Costa Rican soldiers through the jungle, seizes control of the steamboats, these great moments when he pulls up his steamboat alongside another one, and all of a sudden the Costa Rican soldiers rise up from hiding. And he says, "I seize this boat in the name of Cornelius Vanderbilt," and seizes control, cuts off Walker from his reinforcements, and in cooperation with the Costa Ricans, Vanderbilt is responsible for ejecting this international, can only be called an international criminal, who seized control of Nicaragua. Great story. Unfortunately, like the Merrimack story, it goes on from there. And what happened is the new Nicaraguan government, even though they owe their existence in part to Vanderbilt, they don't want North Americans anywhere near Nicaragua. And Vanderbilt goes through a whole story that hasn't been well documented before, where he's trying to get them to reopen the route. And they come close a couple of times and they just can't do it. And so as a result, he ends up competing via Panama, and the man who's the famous anti-monopolist ends up constructing a new monopoly, controlling and with partners in the Pacific over traffic to California. And he ends up becoming the lord and master, basically, of the communication between California and the East Coast. And again, even before the railroads, has amazing power over the American economy. And it all plays out with this background of jungle warfare and backstabbing, and it's quite a story.
I think we have time for one more short question, if anyone would like one more.
I can talk more about the potato chip if you'd like. when you have a book like this, there's so many different elements to bring into it. And again, what I try to do is be accurate, but not obsessively detailed about his business operations and follow that whole drama. And his life played out in a succession of struggles against ever larger opponents, played out on an ever larger stage. So that made, the storytelling really, each chapter kind of, for me at least as the writer, maybe not for you, kind of a satisfying story that keeps building as a part of this larger arc. And that, I tried in my role as historian to say, well, what does this say about what's going on? What are people arguing about in the context of Vanderbilt? What is coming into being, not just the economy, but our values and our culture and society? But then trying to weave through that, Vanderbilt as a person as well and his family life. It's a story that has not been very well told before. Again, he's a man who his longtime clerk said he abominated papers and he would throw them in the fire. And he wrote in one of the few letters of his that survived that he hated writing letters. Someone who could, in the same letter, he could spell the same three-letter word three different ways. And so, there isn't a lot. It's out there. It's scattered around. There isn't a lot of material in his own hand. And so that personal side is something that I really tried to weave into this story. And, again, I did it not only through his first and second wife. His second wife, fortunately, wrote some wonderful letters. He really loved her. He absolutely adored her. Another cousin of his, like his first wife. Someone who he was also could be tough with, but she made clear that he absolutely adored her. And with his children, he had some children, which probably it's his own fault, but they would try any parent's patience. His daughters could be really nasty. Some of them just refused to acknowledge that he'd remarried after the death of their mother, and it just really angered him. That story, it's a very recognizable story that I tried to weave into this business story as well, so that we get a try to build a full portrait of an individual who's living out this changing American landscape that in so many ways, leads to the world that we are in today. So if you do buy it, I will be the first to admit it's a long book, but hopefully it moves along. That's what I tried to do at least.
All right. Well, on behalf of Cambridge Forum, I want to say thank you very much, T.J. Stiles, for your terrific presentation and for a fantastic book. Thank you very much.
Thank you.